So, hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Datengarten Nummer 66, live aus den Räumlichkeiten des Chaos Computer Clubs Berlin, live aus der Marienstraße 11. Hallo. So, our talk tonight will be held in English, so I will switch to English for the introduction. Welcome. We have three very special guests for you tonight. We have Felix Rehm. No, oh my, forget this. We've got Georg Rehm, hi. We've got Felix Sasaki, and we've got Wendy Seltzer, hi. Felix and Georg are from the DFKI, the German Research Institute for Artificial Intelligence. They are hosting the German-Austrian office of the W3C. And later we will have Wendy Seltzer from the MIT. She is head of technology and society and will give us a talk about securing the open web platform. So we will stream this talk live into the web, and so we will have to keep track and record the audience whenever you have questions. Usually we will hold an Q&A session, and since this is a double feature today, tonight, we will hold two Q&A sessions, one right after the first talk, then we will give in a short pause. And then we will, hear the other talk and have another Q&A session. And in this Q&A session, I will come to you with this mic. And you can ask your question and the people in the stream will hear it. So this is so far everything for me. For now, just have fun with the talk and welcome Felix and Georg.
Is this working? Yes? Great. Thank you very much. Test, test, test. Okay. Thank you very much for the nice introduction. This will be a short overview of how W3C is set up, what is an office, what is W3C worldwide, and then we will have the second talk, the main talk by Wendy, who will go into the depth of the technical topic of security. So, what is W3C? Let me show you some painful misunderstandings. And these misunderstandings are not made up. These are real emails we are getting or phone calls we are getting, people asking for help, having a claim. My website does not work. Can W3C help fixing it? The content of the site is not for children. And the name W3C is written on the site. So in this case, a father was writing that his daughter has some strange content on the computer and we should delete it. The provider of the site owes me money. Can W3C help me to get it? So this is the misperception some people have about W3C. So that W3C would be responsible for the actual content of a web, but that's not true. So W3C is providing the building blocks of a web. What you see here is the building blocks you used, well, you're still using to create content on paper. Various paper sizes from A0, smaller and smaller. So it's this kind of standards that are created via W3C, not the content itself, or not the hosting of content in web servers. So what's W3C? Looking a bit into history, it's a standardization organization founded in 1994 by Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web. It is a membership organization. Today it has around 400 plus members. And the topic is standardization of core web technologies. And these core technologies are around something which in the recent years has been framed as the open web platform. And that includes also the technologies from the beginning of the web, but also more and more looking into vertical industries, into input from research, or into the needs of public administration. On the structure of W3C, W3C is legally represented by four hosts: MIT, where Wendy is attached to in the US, ERISIM in Europe, in France, the Keio University in Japan, and Beihang University in China. So there's a relation, a legal relation between these hosts, and that kind of represents W3C. Where the W3C members who are doing the actual work, so the member companies or other organizations, and where's the W3C team, a team that coordinates the technical work and does the administration. The offices, to put us here, Georg and I, into the picture, are local contact points. So not the drivers of the work, but contact points who help creating events like this year. We have a connection to local industry to gather input, to disseminate what's happening in W3C, and also to research and administration, and to coordinate between local standardization activities and the worldwide ones. So here you see the faces of a worldwide W3C team, at least some of the faces, and you also see Tim on this picture. And here you see the faces of a German-Austrian office, Georg, the manager of his office, me as the deputy manager, and Christoph Kempel, who is here in the audience, very nice to have you here, who just recently joined us. So why is W3C not a company? Very important in standardization is independency and trust. And the academic institutions that are hosting W3C, also including the offices, guarantee that independency. Companies then can join W3C as a neutral place for the technology development. Now, giving a very brief overview of what topics on a very high level are worked on in W3C. First, there's browser technologies, so the core technologies you need to develop applications in browsers, like HTML, the DOM, various JavaScript APIs. There's data representation formats like XML. There's service technologies, not a main topic within W3C, but currently, but in developed in relation with other organizations like the IETF. There's semantic web, or the so-called linked data technologies stack, another way to represent data on the web. There's design with technologies like CSS. There's web architecture, about general architectural principles of a web. And there's devices, so developing technologies for mobile or other devices. So these are very broad technology areas that are put forward in W3C. In recent times, also a vertical view is moving more and more forward in W3C. And that includes looking into various industries and their needs. So I've listed here a few industries that are currently quite prominent in W3C, like automotive industry, digital publishing, entertainment, including TV and broadcasting, web and telecommunications, web of data, web of things, web payments, and web security, which we will hear more about in Wendy's talk later. And there are then kind of orthogonal topics like accessibility or internationalization. Now, what type of groups do you have in W3C? There's regular working groups, which do regular standardization and which have as output W3C so-called recommendations. These are W3C standards. There's interest groups, which do more discussion and preparation of the regular standardization work, community building. It's rather informal, but has a close relation to working groups, and often has an output so-called W3C notes. Then there's community groups. These are pure discussion fora, which are very easy to create without any formal process. Participation does also not require W3C membership. And there's no close relation to working groups, also no output requirement. But it's a way to get new topics easily into W3C, and from that, then bring that into regular standardization. And there's business groups, We also work like community groups, so less formal than the working groups, but we have more involvement, also more support from the WWT staff, and still closer relation to the real standardization. So you may wonder, why are these different types of groups needed? Where there's different expectations why people are participate in W3C work. Some want to create a new piece of technology and then want to start a working group, a formal standardization group. Some want to find business partners, so we just need a platform to discuss topics, or partners also for research projects, which have a close relation in some cases also to standardization. Some want to learn about the next big thing in a specific area, or get public research or industry recognition for contributing to the future of the web. These different groups respond in different ways to these requirements for participating in W3C. Let me touch very briefly on the aspects of patents. You may think, why does it matter with standards? One key aspect when you deploy technologies, I'm sure you're aware, is that you know under what licensing conditions is it available, and you are aware of popular license like the Creative Commons licenses. W3C requires for all standard output that the output is under royalty-free license, so that each standard can be implemented without any licensing fees to be paid to license owners. People contributing actual intellectual property to standards then also need to follow the W3C royalty-free patent policy. So this also leads to the formal aspect of developing a standard, how to check whether a technology has some relations to standard. There is a document called the W3C process, so something which you don't need to read when you contribute something, but which you should be aware of, that this exists as the formal backbone of W3C work. It defines the licensing aspects I just mentioned together with other documents. It defines also parts of the organizational structure I mentioned. Includes regulations, how to check about licensing issues, or as a key part, the so-called recommendation track process. So how to get from an early draft of a technology to a final standard, to a recommendation. So here's a short summary of this process. You start with the first public working draft in a working group. So this process is for working groups with the aim to create a formal standard. If there are no changes, then you publish a so-called candidate recommendation and implementation work is going on. If there are no changes during implementation work, then a proposed recommendation is published for internal review by the members. And if there are no changes, then publication of a final standard is done. So if there are changes in these various phases, then you may have several iterations. And especially in the candidate recommendation phase, testing is required. So you need at least two implementations and testing which shows that the implementations behave the same way. And if sometimes changes are needed to the specification itself, then you need to get back again to a previous state. But that assures the stability of the technology and also the broad consensus, since all of these stages allows also public feedback. So why all this effort? Coming back again to the reason why people want to contribute to standardization, they do it for these various reasons that I mentioned before, like creating the technology, finding partners in business and research, and so on. And because they want to contribute to hot topics on the web. And we learn more in a minute about one area by Wendy. So, if you wonder how to contribute, there's various ways before joining W3C formally. There's mailing list, which often you are free to subscribe, where the community groups that I mentioned before, which are free to join without a membership. There's also regular participation with certain fees, depending on what type of organization you are or workflow. But then there's why. Why should you contribute? And that has a perspective, as I said, from various technology developers. But also, and that's very challenging aspect of standardization, What's important is to get contribution from users. Users who often know how a certain technology should be, but who are not sitting at the table directly in the standardization forum. So even if this is a rather informal way to contribute, this feedback is essential for the technology development to be successful. So you could frame it under this phrase here, this is your web. If you see something broken, help to fix it. So this was my short overview about Java3C.
Huge applause. Thank you, Felix. This is your applause. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. Okay, so are there any questions? Here.
To the, a question for the last slide before that one. Right. So in the past, I've at one point been tempted to actually contribute to this process. And what I found was that this regular membership thing is really like totally unaffordable for anyone but a like largest commercial entity. So especially for an individual like me. What is the rationale behind that? And why is that needed?
Well, one reason is why is it needed is one asset of Java3C is that it's not only managing the standard, but that has the technical stuff which really puts a lot of technical also insights in developing the standard that has to be supported by fees. But one other item is that if you think of really large companies, for them, paying these fees, it's not a big issue. And there are various fees levels. I know your point. There are various fees levels, levels of fees, where W3C tries to give different types of fees to different types of organizations and persons. And we constantly hear the feedback, it's still too expensive. And it's still for the way I am working, let's say I'm a freelancer, I'm a 10-person company, I have an area I want to contribute, I can't do it. So that is a constant discussion, and there's a constant discussion also on adjusting fee structure. So a few years ago, for example, a startup fee was introduced, so that small companies with a fee less than 2,000 euro can also participate. But still, I mean, for smaller companies who may stay small for many, many years, that may still be a lot of money. So I know the issue. I'm just saying there's a reason why this money is needed, because standards are not coming for free. So it is a lot of effort to develop this. There is, however, also a mechanism called invited expert, which allows people to contribute to groups because of their technical knowledge. That's a case-by-case basis. So the normal case is to be a certain type of organization and then pay the fee, which is related to that. But that also allows then the expert to contribute after some discussion. And that's one item I want to emphasize finally. Most of the work now is working in public. So it's really that only, let's say, the some management decisions are discussed internally in the membership, in the team. But the actual technical work is done in public. Most of the time, actually, these days in GitHub. So all you need is and public GitHub repository. So you can follow this work. You can also raise issues against this work. Of course, when if it's a substantial contribution, then there starts this discussion about membership and so on. But I think starting to look into the work, seeing where to contribute, that's our possible already now because of this open way of working.
A small remark: invited expert from the W3C sounds very high, but in fact, my experience was you write two emails to a mailing list, and if they like what you say, they are like, "Come on, come on, come by, we pay you." And no, they don't pay you money, in fact, but they help you to get there, and it was a very warm welcome when I used to be there at a TPEC. And I know many other people who are not in big companies, but rather small open source companies, who are there as invited experts and for years. So if you want to go there, it's definitely no problem. To be a real member. But I don't think it's only the fee. It makes sure if you can afford that fee, because it's really work. You have to be there in a working group once a week, I think. In the telco, you really have to do work in between this time. So usually a small company even can't afford this. So if they had the money to pay the fee, that would be okay. But the time to spend so much on a working group, you don't usually have in small companies.
Yeah, and I say that's actually also an issue for the bigger companies, not the fee, but saying we have engineers and we dedicate them to a group. So that's actually most expensive part.
So we've got another question back here.
Hi. One of the working groups, or one of the most popular working groups in your organization, is probably the HTML working group, right? I would say it is. At least one of the most popular ones. A few years back, we've seen the browser vendors come up with their own working group in what is known as WatWG. There seems to be an interesting relationship. Can you describe it?
The relationship between the HTML working group and the what working group? Well, I think a lot of his relationship, a lot of it talking about is history. So the history part was that several years ago, W3C had the vision that the next HTML would be XHTML, an XML-based version. But then, I'd say the community, and then a group, I'd say not only by companies, but the developers said, no, we want to go a different direction, and this is happening outside W3C. And then the WOP working group is the, so to say, naming of this community. But I think it was really companies, but also community going that way, in a that different way. But at some point, W3C realized that it doesn't make sense to try to push something against what the community, including the browser vendors, wants. So this is when close collaboration with WOT Working Group started. And if you now look into the details of what WOT Working Group is still producing, what W3C is producing, so HTML itself is closely aligned, other specifications, API specifications are closely aligned. They're still in W3C more focused on, let's say, the stability, and in WOT Working Group community more on evolving things overnight, so to say. Just see what is the next feature. But still, it's that's the most important point, I think, close collaboration. And it's not going into totally different directions.
I also have a detailed question. It's like, how do you deal with fundamental conflicts inside those sanitization agreements? For example, let's say the entertainment stuff probably includes DRM. So there are contradicting goals of, the open internet and open web. So how do you deal with it, and how do you solve conflicts and such disagreements?
Sorry, conflicts and what?
Such disagreements on how to move forward.
I think there is no golden bullet to always solve a conflict, and especially the topic of DRM is a highly political conflict. And I think W3C mostly tries to stay out of politics as much as possible, and just see what various communities, including companies, want. Try to balance this interest of companies and of various users' needs, and also community groups. I mean, especially in the DRM area, there are communities who say, okay, there shouldn't be DRM. I think the general approach of W3C, independent of its DRM topic is under a headline which has been created for the IETF, the Internet Task Force. We believe in rough consensus and running code. So it's a very implementation-driven approach for technical work. That's the reason why there was this candidate recommendation step in the various steps I showed, where testing is needed to make sure that things are really working. And formality is important to be able to move forward, but it's a rough consensus. So that you try to get assurance that there's a consensus to move in different direction without going into too much details of a formality, because it just takes too long. I think that's the general approach, and then it is a case-by-case basis. And there are hot topics like nowadays DRM, a few years ago, like the video element in HTML and video codecs, and before that HTML versus XHTML, where it is really a case-by-case basis and a lot of community building, communicating, talking to the people who have a different opinion, and then see how to include them as much as people as possible.
Have we any more questions? Any more questions from the audience? Okay, so one last question for me. How can I parse HTML with regular expressions? Okay. So, thank you, Felix. And we will take a short break now. And we will be back in about 15 minutes with our next talk from Wendy on securing the open web platform. Okay. So we are back. Welcome to our second part of our Datengarten 66, live from the CCC in Berlin. Our second part will be a talk from Wendy Seltzer. Welcome, and a short applause. So, the talk will be about web security or security, and it is called Securing the Open Web Platform. And yeah, without any more hesitation, I will give the mic to Wendy, and yeah. Have fun with the talk and enjoy.
Great, thank you so much. Thanks for coming out to join the conversation on web security. And as any of you who's been watching the news or watching your computers lately knows, there's plenty to talk about and plenty of challenge in securing the web. Plenty of problems with logos and without. So how do we come to talk about securing the web platform while preserving its essentials? The internet and the web were designed without much thought to security. They were designed for the sharing of information, and the primary goal was to put information up and easily accessible. And the first versions of the web give us terms that are mostly still valid in HTML5, published in 2014. This would be recognizable to a web browser today, even though it was published in 1999. So we've got the challenge of layering. How do we build security into platforms that were built without security considerations? And we've got the challenge of generativity. So although that starts out simple, it's done, given birth to a huge amount of variety. And if your favorite website or web application isn't posted there, well, that's partly the point, because the web isn't constrained by what I can imagine, or what Sir Tim could imagine, or what any one of us in this room could imagine. It's an open platform where anyone can build anything that they can imagine using the tools that web standards launch it, and again, if it's interesting, it takes off, and if it's a dud, well, it languishes in a corner, and eventually they take the server offline, and or at least you hope they take it off before it becomes a haven for its own sort of security problems. So how do we preserve this tremendous generativity of the web and protect it? You could contrast the web to proprietary platforms. Pick on Apple. Apple's a member, they're a great company, but they have a platform that they control quite closely, the iOS ecosystem, where they sell the hardware, they sell the operating system, they sell software on top of it, they approve apps to go into the App Store and give some degree of vetting. So they have ownership of that whole stack and some incentive to manage its security. So that means, of course, there are no security problems on the iOS platform, right? Well, not exactly, but it does mean that you have someone to point a finger at if there is a problem, and Apple can go into your iPhone and pull back apps that have been discovered to be problematic because they have that degree of control, and they can set new guidelines for app developers if they discover problems with the platform. They can push out updates to you automatically if problems emerge, and so they can iterate rapidly, and they can update for security or functionality reasons in ways that it's harder to do on an open platform. But the open platform has its advantages too. Of the 25 billion apps downloaded in the App Store, there are various apps that haven't been permitted because they don't fit with Apple's business models, or they don't fit with Apple's views of what the platform should host. And so it's not absolutely anything that you can find there as it is on the web. So the challenge, by contrast, on the web is the problem of or potential tragedy of the commons. So ecologist Garrett Hardin pointed out that on a unmanaged, unowned commons, you could have everyone rushing in to send their animals to feed as much as they wanted, and eventually this grass would be nibbled down to stubs and there'd be nothing left, and everybody would be worse off because nobody was guarding the commons, and nobody had the incentive to protect the commons and preserve its resources. So is this the challenge of the web? Or is it more, as Eleanor Ostrom noted, is it a comedy of the commons? In fact, there are commons spaces that are managed by people and groups of people that function quite well. And commons don't get nibbled down to the stubs, and fisheries and lobster fisheries and waterways don't get overfished and managed down to dry stream beds because people come together and work cooperatively to manage the commons. And they can do that when they share goals about the overall resource, when they share an understanding of the community that they're part of, when there are reasonable rules and ways to monitor that others are following those rules, and when people can see that they benefit from being part of a more orderly arrangement. So instead of going into the fishing bed and taking out as many fish as you can possibly catch, if you take only your quota and leave the rest for the other fishermen and leave fish to spawn so that next year there are more fish repopulating the area, you'll be better off long term, and you can monitor the other fishermen and fisherwomen too, and make sure that overall people are respecting the commons. And that's one of the roles that the World Wide Web Consortium plays. We help to steward the commons of the open web platform. We help to coordinate the players who have various interests, some shared and some competitive, to come together to improve the platform. And so it's voluntary standard setting. No one is forcing you to obey HTML. We can't put a tag in there that says break if you disobey the standard, but people recognize that by speaking a common language, by working together on common standards, they have greater reach. The network effects of what they publish will be wider, and the opportunities for all will be better. And so, along with that general approach to the collective action challenges, W3C can apply that in web security. And we do that by modularizing the problem, addressing it piece by piece, and building the components for end-to-end security, components for trustworthy and secure communication. And so the incentives for all of the participants in here is cooperate to keep the platform working so that you can compete on top of the platform. If we all work together to build the web platform, the foundations, then each of us can individually compete to be the best website, the best search engine, the best news source, the best video content, the best streaming platform, the best place to reach our particular audience without having to worry about, will the platform keep working underneath? Will people be too afraid to use the web because they've heard of its security flaws and don't know if it'll keep working tomorrow? So let's dive a little bit further into security. When we talk about security, we can mean all sorts of different things. A few of those, we might be talking about confidentiality, availability, integrity. Those terms are important to security researchers and those trying to assure the security of systems. Sometimes, to some users of the web, they seem less important. You know, we're interested in rapid deployment and ease of interoperability and extensibility and how do I get my cool, flashy app up there quicker? How do we also get you thinking about confidentiality and integrity? You could think about security as correct operation. Does the app you deployed work as you intended? Well, the web as a whole doesn't guarantee correct operation. The web has 404s, and those are an integral part of the web that you can click a link and it doesn't work because the alternative would be make you revalidate that page until you got rid of all the broken links. And if you tried to keep up with all of the changes in the web before you ever published a page, you might not ever get to publish. So we decide it's less bad, or we collectively decide, the system, it's less bad if some of those links break and you can't follow them, but overall, the web as a whole continues to work. Now, at the same time, browsers try very hard to render whatever is presented to them because users will attribute, you know, this doesn't work in my browser. My browser must be broken. I'll go try a different browser. Rather than this doesn't work. Maybe the web page author did something wrong. I'll go try a different website. Again, browsers, when they're making security-related decisions, need a place to work together to say, we all collectively want higher security, even if that means that some of the lower security sites will break. If we all break things together for the security of the web, then web developers will have the right motivation to fix things. Now, we try not to break things, but we do sometimes have to deprecate things that have been found to be insecure and are anti-patterns. And then Postel's law of robustness, be conservative in what you do and be liberal in what you accept from others, describes a lot of what we see on the web, and we need to if we're going to be liberal in what we accept, we need to be conservative in how we parse it and what we do with it to make sure that it doesn't subject us to security vulnerabilities. So I want to run through some patterns that demonstrate sort of the emergent security model of the web. So even if the web wasn't built with security as at its heart, we have been developing, as the web develops, models and components of that model that help us to operate more securely. The same origin policy, increased use of encryption, and increasingly browser cooperation with the web application to blunt the threat that sort of mobile code deployed to the browser becomes an attack vector inside firewalls and organizations. The other challenge in thinking about security on a global platform is to think about the threat modeling. So you can't talk about security until, without a threat model of for whom and from what. And those threat models will vary with each user and use of the web. And one person's insecurity is another person's feature. How do we adapt to secure the system to improve our options for security without breaking the features that make the web great. So let's run through a few of those security quest and threat modeling questions. Is this a so the problem of phishing, as we know, is how do we recognize a site when we visit it for the first time, and or when we're given a link in an email or a link from another site and asked to figure out, is this the site where I want to do my banking? Is this the site where I want to exchange social information or get my news? Well, we recognize the fish based on, you know, have we seen it before? Does it look like things that we recognize? Has a trusted party introduced it to us? Do we get warnings from trusted people that maybe this is an anglerfish and we shouldn't go too close? On the web, we can give those warnings, but we don't want to, you know, go too far in the warning. You know, we could address the phishing problem by forcing every site to be vetted before it was posted. Oops, that site looks too much like a banking site and it isn't issued by a bank. Let's make sure to keep it off the web. That site looks like a social networking site, but it's Facebook instead of Facebook, and we can't have any of that. And if we had that kind of vetting process, it would undermine the notion of the permissionless innovation. It would make it much more costly to deploy websites. It would make it much more challenging to build something new, but it might get rid of these phishing imposters. Maybe there's a better way. Maybe there's a way we can preserve the opportunity for fish to look very different and still have a place in the web ecosystem. Instead of, if we can't stop fishing, maybe we can make the sign-on credentials unfishable. You know, the big problem with fishing isn't that sites are popping up that we haven't seen before, it's that we trust them and think they are the same as the site we saw before and give them our password, and that lets them clean out our bank account. So if the password that we share with our bank doesn't work when imposter fake bank pops up a website, then a big piece of the phishing problem goes away. And so the web authentication work that we're doing builds on work of the FIDO Alliance with multi-factor authentication and strong cryptography to make the credential unfishable. As this working group moves forward, it's working on a two-step authentication process. You authenticate locally with some strong authentication. Could be biometrics, it could be a password, it could be a hardware key, it could be a token stored in a secure environment on your computer or on your mobile device. And you do that locally, that unlocks key material on your local device that you exchange with a server, the application that you're trying to issue, you're trying to speak to, and those credentials are bound to the origin. So if your bank has issued you a key, that won't work anyplace else. And if Imposter Bank tries to ask you for a login, it won't get anything that is that it can convey as man in the middle to your real bank. It won't get any access to your account, and and if to look an awful like your bank and makes you try that fingerprint authentication many times, the imposter will get nothing that it's useful to it to impersonate you, and so. This work is underway. The Web Authentication Working Group will be meeting here this Friday and working to build the web API that lets sort of any web application depend on having this strong authentication available. Another piece of the web security, same origin. Policy. Like the single origin chocolate here, same origin is an information flow policy designed to help keep information contained so that you've logged in and gotten special access again to your bank account. Another website shouldn't be able to pop up a script and demand access to that bank account, either through data stored on your computer or by launching requests of its own from your browser. The same origin policy contains that. Now, some people find the same origin policy too constraining. Applications, they want to access data from multiple origins. The web Mint built a business on showing you all of your balances and transactions together by pulling in all of the data from all of your different bank accounts into one place. They do that by asking you to give them your usernames and passwords to your different bank accounts and collecting all of that information for you. They promise that they're only using it on your behalf. And be the master of your money once you've delegated control to them. Is this an attack on the bank websites that are thinking that they're giving your financial information to you? Or is it a site that's acting on behalf of the user because the user has asked them to collect this information in one place? After all, users are entitled to delegate some security decisions. We can't sort of decide upfront that this is a good use or a bad use. What we can do is give people, both site designers and site users, the tools with which to decide, is this something I want to enable? Is this something I don't want to enable? And so CORS, the cross-origin cross-origin resource sharing, is a way for web application authors to describe what permissions they want to grant or deny to cross-origin sharing. And this is, it's got pieces that are a little brown and annoying to use for web developers. And yet it's got pieces that are important elements of backwards compatibility of the web security. Because lots of pieces of web of older technology were deployed behind, thinking that they'd be behind firewalls, out of reach of nasty applications probing all of their ports and trying to get them to overheat, or thinking that their data store was protected because it was behind a firewall and nobody was going to think to look at that super secret port to find where the database was exposed. And so the web browser implements some of these controls to help the ecosystem protect itself. It's not that CORS is impregnable. You You could launch your own web browser that obeyed none of these rules, but the goal is to avoid having sort of deployed browsers everywhere that will accept code that can be turned into a hack, and to strike that balance, giving the user and the application author the right powers and controls. And so Web Application Security Working Group has a series of additional specs that that help to sort of enlist the user agent to help protect the user and the web application. We have specs in development on content security policy, CSP, CSP pinning, enabling web app authors to set a site-wide content security policy, restrictions, UI security, sub-resource integrity just went to proposed recommendation today, woohoo. That's the second to last step in that process that Felix showed, just before it gets to recommendation. So sub-resource integrity lets you indicate for sub-resources in a web page, like scripts or style sheets, what resource you're expecting by giving a hash value, a hash along with the resource itself, and the browser will verify that the hash matches the what it receives from, say, a content delivery network before loading. And if someone takes over your CDN and tries to insert malicious scripts, sub-resource integrity will help you to protect your site and your users against that attack. A bunch more security on permissions API to help to consolidate the suite of things that we're asking users and how we ask them to respond to requests for microphone access and video camera access and geolocation access, and can we store some data here, and can we access some cookies there, helping to give the user a more consolidated picture of what permissions are granted, and helping sites and applications to ask for them in a more cohesive manner. A few other experiments going on there. If any of these are interesting to you, come check out the work of the Web App Sec group. Yet another of our security conundrums is the question sort of interception or assistance. There are various service providers and ISPs and employers who run networks who say we need to be able to manage the traffic on our network. And sometimes they say it's to filter spam. You wouldn't want all that spam in your email. We need to read all your emails so that we can tell what's spam. We want to help you by saving on your data package, by offering you video and image compression, but we need to read the images in order to be able to do that. We need to be able to do traffic management and quality of service to make sure your voice and gaming apps are performing as they should. So we need to be able to read that traffic. Sure, sometimes that might be helpful. If you as a user opt into that, you as an employee recognize that, yes, your employer needs to read all of the traffic on the network, and therefore you'll be very careful what you do on that network. That's a use case, but it's not the use case for all of your network traffic. And so encryption gives us the tools to turn that on or off. Say if we don't want spam filtering, we don't want the interception that comes along with it, encrypt those streams, and we'll handle it ourselves. And so we've seen encryption moving everywhere across the web and throughout the internet stack, both W3C and IETF looked at the problem of of pervasive monitoring as an attack on the network and said it's appropriate that in all of our protocol design, we look at security, we introduce end-to-end security where possible and help users to encrypt everywhere. And so at W3C, we have worked to enable HTTPS and make it easier for site authors to deploy that, work like upgrade insecure requests is a header that the site and browser can use to say, even if you see HTTP links there, try them as HTTPS because I can recognize HTTPS, but I've got huge gobs of legacy content that it's difficult to change every link. So try it encrypted first. And along with public key pinning, you can upgrade the links automatically and get the benefits of HTTPS everywhere. The secure context spec says, yeah, there might once have been a time when users were expecting everything they did to travel in the clear. That's not anymore. We've seen fire sheep, we've seen cookie stealing, we've seen Wi-Fi sniffing imposters, we've seen men in the middle. We don't want to trust anyone to access our geolocation or our microphone or our video camera. That should only happen from sites that have authenticated themselves to us by presenting a certificate and have given us end-to-end assurances with an HTTPS connection. And so the secure context spec says powerful features should be available only in those secure contexts. And the browser should not offer those features to an HTTP page because anyone could be issuing that request and not necessarily anyone you have any reason to trust. Lots of great efforts outside of W3C Let's Encrypt, if you haven't tried that out yet, generate your own SSL certificate for free with neat auto-renewal tools and fully scriptable interfaces. No site should be out there that doesn't have a secure connection. Certificate transparency, some work on helping to detect certificate misissuance and help us to figure out whether the issuers of certificates are the ones we expected and should be trusting with the security of the websites we're visiting. Also, we've got the Web Crypto API. So want to build secure messaging. Build web applications that can take advantage of crypto features. Instead of writing your own crypto, which is really not ever a good idea, even if you're a cryptographer, unless you get lots of peer review, you can use standard features across browsers now. The Web Crypto API is in its candidate recommendation phase, just about to get to proposed recommendation. We do interop testing and assure that all of the features that are written into the spec actually work before they get to recommendation. In the case of Web Crypto, where there's lots of detail around, you know, what is the key format and how is it encoded, making sure that browsers interpret that in the same way requires lots of testing. And the TAG, the Technical Architecture Group, has given us a couple of findings on securing the web and end-to-end encryption, again, re-emphasizing the importance as a technical and architectural matter of giving users and application developers the control that encryption brings. Encryption lets the user make a contract with the application provider that only the two of them can see or modify the traffic and those in between can't. Of course, there are challenges to encryption too, and it's tough to get it right and tough to use good randomness and tough to use all of the pieces correctly, but better to be using encryption than and keeping up with the upgrades. So finally, we need to think about designing for openness from the beginning. So some lessons from other fields that the web had the benefit of being designed open and working to add security. Some other systems start out thinking that they're closed systems, and who needs security at all? Because, you know, who's ever going to get anywhere near our CAN bus that's exchanging automotive information? If you put an MP3 CD into certain cars, that gives you access to the CAN bus and lets you set the brakes. That ODDB2 port that lets you run diagnosis information doesn't have much security, or Bluetooth, or OnStar, or as soon as you try to interface these things to open systems, you're giving attackers a whole new surface area to work with, and attackers are clever and numerous, and if it only takes one attack to bring down your automotive network, then you need to be doing some more thinking about your automotive network. Similarly, this was a talk at 32C3 this past year on payment networks and the challenges of, you know, these things had thought they were communicating over closed networks. Why would the internet come anywhere near them? So why worry too much about the security of key material? Well, worry about the security of key material, but, you know, this exchange, nobody's going to be snooping on that until they are, because you plug into an unoccupied Ethernet jack next to where the payment terminal is and find that you get access to lots more than intended. How do we deal with, you know, the upcoming Internet of Things and all of the security challenges that will bring? We need to be thinking about these as open, interconnected systems from the start, build for open, review for security at every stage, think about and mitigate attacks, security and privacy risks at every stage of design, offer guidance to developers on designing securely, and make sure that the tools help users to protect themselves. Don't expect that your device will always be sitting behind a secure gateway, so why bother with its security? If you get through the hard shell and find a soft, squishy center, it's still soft and squishy. So, the web, multi-use commons, we've got people with different goals, different aspirations, and different security models. Nonetheless, I think we can work to secure it, and we know we can't predict user intent, we don't control the ecosystem, incentives vary, and there are all these users out there. Some security people like to blame the users or say, stupid users, you can't trust them with anything. I'm not going to do that. I think take our users very seriously, and users come first. Users are the people we are designing this web for. But that doesn't mean that we should always do whatever the user asks, because we need to give users the tools to understand the situations they're in and the tools to delegate their security questions to those who might be more expert than they are. So we shouldn't expect every user to be a computer security expert. We should expect them to be an expert in their own personal risk analysis Only if we've given them the tools to understand the risks and to help manage that, which means don't ask the user questions to which they have no way of knowing the answer, but build interfaces that help them to learn the answers when it's important and when they would actually have a reason to make a decision, and to allow them to delegate decisions to somebody else, like the maker of their web browser or the curator of a set of links, when they don't want to have to decide. Encryption with effective key management can help make the participation explicit, so the user can delegate that choice to somebody, to a sysadmin, to an operator, to somebody they trust with their computer security, and keep the others out of that decision. Instead of trust the platform or secure the platform, what I think what we're doing in web security is building a toolbox for trust among users. And that toolbox includes end-to-end principles, it includes modular security components, it includes encryption everywhere we can get it working, it includes building systems, expecting them to be open, and enlisting and enabling the user to participate in security. So with that, a few links to leave you with. If you want to join any of these activities, as Felix said, we welcome invited experts in lots of our groups. And if you're a developer and you read through one of these specs and you find a bug, please report it. We operate mostly on GitHub. If you find something that's unclear and you can't figure out how to implement or use it, please file an issue. If there's something you think doesn't work the way it should, please come and join the discussion and help us to figure out how it should work better. We've got some of these that are nearly wrapped up, like web crypto. We've got some that are just getting started, like web authentication. And the newest, a community group around hardware-based secure services, is looking at how should the web interface effectively with hardware security. What's the right interface and what's the right design pattern to follow if you want the web to leverage a trusted execution environment or a TPM? And finally, with thanks to all of those from whom I borrowed images, and thank you very much for listening and helping us to secure the web.
So, thank you for this awesome talk. We start with our Q&A session. Do we have any questions from the audience? Right in the back, I'm coming.
First of all, thank you for the insight. My question would be, so we've been hearing a lot about browser-based security, obviously because browsers are the primary target for the, or the primary, well, consumers of the web, if you will. Now there's been an interesting discussion lately on user agents that are not strictly browsers, but still need to use the web and all its technologies that get inherently more complex, so they are basically forced to use browser engines. Now, the problems with browser engines, both in embedded or in Linux distributions, is that they tend to age. And as you said, you have a tendency to sometimes basically deprecate technologies, and there are bugs in these engines. So just to make it short, is there any advice, any viewpoint that the V3W organization has to on that matter of aging browser engines in non-browsers, in non-browser user agents?
Let's see. It's a a tough question to address because the life cycle of software is indeed getting sort of shorter as we have technologies that update rapidly and, you know, try to deprecate things that have been found to be buggy, and yet people want backwards compatibility, and especially as they're buying devices, don't want those devices to go obsolete. Don't want the phone that you just bought to be non-functional. And the Internet of Things, we see companies struggling with the, do we just brick all those old devices that people bought because they're insecure, or do we find ways to roll out upgrades? So, I mean, I guess step one would be think about the upgrade path for any software that you're deploying, and if you have no way of updating it once it's out in the field, then try to give it as small a footprint as you can. Do you really need to use an entire browser engine, or are you just trying to parse some strings and can use something much simpler? Don't throw a browser at the problem if it's not a web browser sized challenge.
Okay, any more questions? None. Okay. So there is currently a huge discussion going on between, for example, publishers and users regarding ad blockers and, it's basically code execution on foreign pages. And, are there any possible ways to do this in a reasonable, secure way?
The ad block sort of wars escalate, at least in part because of the sort of weight of ads that are as advertisement code is added to web pages. So various studies have shown that both the amount of data pulled down, the amount of time a page spends rendering, and the amount of code execution are all sort of disproportionately from the advertisements rather than from the content they're supporting. And so that, you know, gets users angry and wanting to block the ads, and you know sometimes ad networks are vectors for malicious code, and that makes users feel even more justified in blocking those additions. Some of the tools that we could work with are sort of better sandboxes for the active content in a web page, so that the ad can't jump out and redirect you or change settings or steal data, to do that requires getting the advertisers to accept a slightly narrower set of capabilities, like shouldn't be jumping full screen and changing settings, but. In return, they would get a more trustworthy platform. We also are encouraging advertisers to move to HTTPS so that you know that it's actually the ads they were intending to distribute and the ads that the publisher was intending to put into the page that you're getting and not somebody else hijacking an ad network for fun and profit. I think we have tried at W3C efforts like the Do Not Track to build some middle ground for users to signal privacy preferences, and we haven't seen a whole lot of interest from publishers in respecting that and doing anything different for a user who sets Do Not Track. So we'll keep trying to find places where we can come to sort of a cooperative agreement among the parties, and I think as the technology improves, it gives better ways for publishers and advertisers to offer, reader-friendly versions of the pages that still pay the rent if that's how a publisher has chosen to fund their enterprise.
Thank you. So, oh, we've got another question right in the front. So,
I'm interested in terms of the infrastructure. How do you see the development of the web, like that big internet companies are going to like own also the infrastructure, and that's then still not like the web, the free web anymore, like with Facebook and so on. So if it's all combined on one hand, do you have any like statements or like commenting this?
Well, I think there are sort of the technical pieces and then sort of the economic aspects to sort of what we can find on the web. And technically, we are doing a lot to ensure that the web remains accessible and interoperable and to development by anybody. We can do less. Certainly from the W3C side, we can't do anything to sort of change the economic picture. If everyone is finding new links through Facebook, then we become awfully dependent on what sorts of links Facebook surfaces in its feed. And you know, we can stand up our own sites and work to compete as individuals and as collectives, but you know, we have to do more work to get other users interested in those offerings. And I think on some of the connection between sort of content and infrastructure, we've seen a lot of pushback to plans like the zero rating plan that the internet.org consortium offered as, you know, get free access to our vetted sites, and maybe you'll never notice that there's another internet over there that has other sites that you might also like to access, is one reading of it. Their reading of it was, we want to help people get access to content, and this is the best way we can get the carriers to cooperate. So I think on the there are good efforts around sort of re-decentralize the web and building the infrastructure to make sure that we can continue to find the independent sites and independent connections. And ultimately, it's a social challenge of how do we keep finding one another even when there are sort of others trying to dominate the conversation.
Any more questions? Right here.
Well, not really a question, but rather trying to create some food for thought. Of course, Case Computer Club is unique, so there's no question about it. But I'm sure you have a lot of conversations with, let's say, a critical type of developers crowd in other countries as well. So this is one type of user, you might say, this is the absolute end user who doesn't know anything about web. But let's say when you have similar conversations to this critical developers cloud, would you say you get certain type of feedback? What's missing? What's going into right direction, wrong direction with technologies being developed? Or is it quite a heterogeneous picture across various countries and communities?
Yes. Users and their demands from the web vary widely, I think, and it's hard to characterize them. I think here there is a very strong computer security and ethical hacking community of people who recognize that the value of breaking rules in order to make them better, we like that on the web too. If you find a bug in one of our specs, please come and tell us about it so that that we can fix it and roll that out before technology is deployed. And you know, I think to the end user, it's most important to keep talking about sort of the possibilities of the technology, that you know, the web is not just whatever you happen to be browsing right now. It's not just the applications that are out there today, but it's also the possibility of building something new. And we're going to keep the web sort of view sourceable so that end users can see the possibility that they too could become developers and build their own applications on top.
Good. Absolutely. Yeah. Any more questions? If not, then I want you to give a large applause to Wendy. Thank you. Thank you for the awesome talk and the awesome Q&A session.
Thank you very much for being an awesome audience.
Yeah. So, I think we are finished for today. Still any possible method of parsing HTML with regular expressions? Okay, so I guess I have to fall back to Stack Overflow with this one. Good. So, thank you for being our audience tonight. Thank you for being here. And so, I think I close the Dartengarten number 66. Have a good night and join us next time. Bye.